Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, one in five Australians live with chronic pain. You might be one of them. It's a tough card to be dealt, especially if you've been dealing with that pain for a large part of your life. Not just you, of course, but carers as well, who are involved in caring for people with chronic pain. About 105,000 people were hospitalised with chronic pain in 2017-18, well, the typical hospital stay three times longer than average. The most common forms of pain are back, shoulder and neck pain, and sometimes chronic pain can be the result of an injury. In other cases, it can be the result of your particular physiology or even genetic inheritance. The good news is that we are currently undergoing a massive revolution as to what we know about chronic pain. It's fair to say a lot of the old thinking has been turfed out on the basis of evidence, and understandings of why chronic pain happens and how it can be treated are quite different today. It's not just about taking painkillers. There's a huge psychological aspect to experiencing pain, and one that we will explore tonight. Joining us tonight, Associate Professor Michael Vagg. Now, Michael is a rehabilitation and pain doctor. He's also the Dean of the Faculty of Pain Medicine at the Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists. Michael, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks very much, Philip. It's great to be here.
Yes, well, terrific to have you with us as well. What are we, when we use the term chronic pain, what do we mean?
Sure. So most things that happen to the body that cause pain are associated, you know, the things you grow up with and the things that you're used to is if you're injured or if you're unwell, the pain can be a symptom of that injury. And most of the time you expect that the pain will go away when whatever the problem is or whatever the injury is heals. So pain that persists for 3 months or more longer than what you would expect it to have settled down is what we call chronic pain. Some people think chronic means severe, but it actually means persistent over time.
So it just means long lasting. It won't go away.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Because that's the thing generally when we even use the word pain, we tend to think of it as a fleeting thing. Well, not fleeting, but it's a temporary thing, isn't it? I mean, you get pain when something happens and it hurts, but then the pain always goes away.
Exactly. And a lot of the frustration that people with chronic pain feel is the result of them trying to use the strategies which work for normal pain on chronic pain, which isn't wired the same as normal pain. And so therefore the normal things that you expect to happen with normal pain don't happen when you apply those strategies to chronic pain.
What, I mean, this might sound like a silly question, but I don't think it is. When we use the term pain, what is pain anyway?
That's not a silly question at all, because it's actually quite difficult to define. And there's a body called the International Association for the Study of Pain, or the IASP, who have they're the sort of umbrella group that set the research agenda in all sorts of pain research. And they've had a number of goes at refining the definition of pain over the years, and they've just updated it only a few months ago for about the third or fourth time since the 1980s. And so I won't give you the full definition because it's a bit wordy, but basically what they're emphasizing is that when you experience pain, it isn't just the same thing as experiencing a signal of tissue damage, because your experience of pain is influenced by a huge number of different inputs. Mm. As you mentioned in your intro, the genetics of an individual strongly influence how much and what type of pain they may get from a given injury. And in fact, the experience of that person's nervous system and brain as it's gone through life is also a very important thing that sets the scene, if you like, for whether a particular injury or a particular disease or particular surgery will go on to cause longer term pain.
Yeah, because I mean, if I sprain my ankle, for example, and I, you know, if I turn the ankle before it's healed, it hurts. Mm. But after a while, it doesn't.
Mm. And there's another interesting thing that happens there with that is that when you twist your ankle, you can't not limp on it. Have you ever noticed that?
That's right.
You can try really hard to overcome that tendency not to limp, but you can't keep it up for very long. And what's going on there is that the brain is activating a lot of its unconscious mechanisms to try and keep you safe. And a lot of chronic pain, or a lot of the new understanding we have of chronic pain, has to do with those unconscious areas of brain function and how they maybe overreact, or they can't switch off properly and they keep protecting you long after there's not really a need to.
Hmm.
So twisting ankle is a good example.
Yeah. So if there is actual tissue damage, you feel pain.
Yep.
If you're feeling pain after the tissue has healed,
yep,
then what are you actually feeling? Or is it pain just in your head?
No, well, in a trivial sense, all pain is in your head because, you know, that's what general anesthesia is. If you actually give someone a general anesthetic and you make them go unconscious, then
they don't
experience pain. And in fact, when they wake up, they have no memory of having experienced pain.
Hmm.
And general anesthesia has been somewhat of a mystery as to exactly how it works and what happens. But what is interesting is that some recent work out of the UK has suggested that maybe what happens with general anesthesia is that it's as if the brain essentially stops listening to anything except itself, and it turns all of its attention internally, and the normal attention that gets paid to what's going on external to the brain itself is all switched off. So what it means is that you can't experience pain if you're unconscious, because that message never makes it to the brain to be remembered or to be reacted to.
Mm.
So in that sense, you have to be awake and conscious to experience pain.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of pain, well, with tissue damage, it always seems to me is that the body is saying, don't, you know, press on, settle, put stress on this part of the body while it heals.
Is exactly. It triggers behavior that is what we call nociceptive or pain defending behavior.
Mm.
And a lot of that is not under conscious control. And one of the things that my patients notice sometimes, if I do an injection or a procedure with a bit of local anesthetic that just anesthetizes what might be an area of painful tissue, they will suddenly be able to move quite differently. The brain will stop protecting that area, and it'll allow the normal movement patterns. And it seems like a miracle, but really what's happened is just that the brain has dropped its defensiveness. And in some people, if their pain is being driven by things that are going on, not in the area where they feel it, but higher up in the nervous system, the brain doesn't stop defending that because it's still reading pain signals as coming from that area.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to by any definition of pain, that person's still experiencing pain even if the tissue damage isn't there anymore. It's just pain that's being driven from a different part of the nervous system.
Mm. So how does chronic pain develop? Because from what we're saying, it's there long after any specific tissue damage has healed.
Yep. So some chronic pain is almost chronic from the day when it starts. So if you have someone who has had, say, for example, a lot of painful procedures in hospital before they were 5 years old, just as an example of one of the things that can predispose to long-term pain, you know, that person's nervous system may actually be already really primed to be overprotective.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that person later on in life has an injury that affects, you know, the old area where they had their operations, they may get a disproportionate pain response because all those old pathways are still there and they're getting woken up and activated. So for some people, their pain is different right from the time when the injury or the thing that seems to trigger it happens. But there are other people, for example, people who have an attack of shingles where there is significant damage to a nerve from a viral infection. And the reason why that pain persists over time is because the nerve doesn't completely heal and it remains overly responsive to normal sort of stimulation. So it's a very complicated thing, and trying to unpick in any one individual how much of the pain is being driven by, you know, maybe ongoing pain signals from the tissues, or how much of it is being amplified or added to by the central nervous system, whether that's the brain or the spinal cord or which part of the brain, etc. And all of this takes place within an environment where the brain's what's called the salience networks, the areas of the brain that try and keep you protected, they are influenced by other things in your environment and around you. And interestingly, those parts of the brain do not distinguish between threatening things happening outside you or happening inside you. So for some people, the pain itself can become a trigger for more pain, mm-hmm. because the brain is continuing to search for things to protect you from. And for other people, it may be words or in situations or social interactions which can trigger those areas of the brain to over-respond again. So it's really quite individual.
Okay. It's common, though. Common enough, isn't it, amongst the population? Yeah. Yep. Give us a picture of how common it is.
Yeah, so it's actually a huge public health problem. It's probably the biggest under-recognised public health problem in some respects in the country. So, about 1 in 5 Australians will suffer from it at some point in their life. Hmm. And as far as it can be costed, it costs the economy something around $70 billion a year. And that's the direct costs of treating people who have chronic pain. As you mentioned earlier, the recent figures from the Australian Institute of Health and Wellbeing showed that people who go into hospital with a chronic pain diagnosis stay in hospital much longer than the average person because their treatment is much more complicated. Mm. And so it's chronic pain is also the leading reason why working age people have to leave the workforce, for example. It has a devastating effect on people's ability to earn a living and advance their careers and, support their families and also be part of their families and contribute even if they're not doing paid work.
30 years ago, it was treated differently, wasn't it?
Very much so, yeah.
Tell me about that.
So 30 years ago, we had what these days we would say is a very biomedical approach to chronic pain. There was an awareness that psychological factors and social factors were important, but for a very long time, we've sort of persisted with this illusion that, the bit where you feel the pain is always the problem. And a good example of this is back surgery to treat what people regard as painful discs. So there's been a lot of back surgery done over the years that has left people significantly worse off because the disc actually was never really the problem. The problem was what's going on higher up in the nervous system, and that was never recognized. And so when you then subject somebody who's got a sensitized nervous system to what is actually a potentially painful operation that will sort of cause a lot of anatomy to have to get shifted around, and will also reduce the amount of movement that their back has, then you're actually opening up a whole different set of problems. So, it sort of can get into the situation where it feeds on itself in some cases.
There's been, you're suggesting, a revolution of knowledge in terms of what we know about chronic pain, hasn't there? I mean, over the last 10 years in particular. Can you outline what we've learned about this?
Yeah, so it's becoming increasingly clear, or it has been becoming increasingly clear, that the biomedical approach really wasn't good enough to explain most of what we actually see in the clinic. But it's always challenging in a scientific endeavor where you really don't know where the evidence is going to lead you. And where it has led us over the last 10 or 15 years is a very significant appreciation of things like genetics, of the gut microbiome, of the experiences that people have early in their life, their social connectedness, for example. There's lots of things which we now understand how those things actually impact the nervous system in a way that primes people to have chronic pain. And so it means that, our traditional idea of, okay, if you've got back pain, it must be a problem with your back.
With your back, yeah.
Yeah. And it's complicated further by the fact that there are some people who do have sore backs and there are some people who do have sore knees, people with osteoarthritis, for example. Not all chronic pain is entirely due to those risk factors, but quite a lot of it is. And the goal really these days is we want to try and work out with any given individual. What is all the set of unique factors in this individual, and what's their relative contribution? And so, therefore, if they have a degree of tissue damage that is still there, or it hasn't healed completely, what can we do to sort that out? So we may do injections, procedures, nerve blocks, other things like that. If we come to the conclusion, actually, people have already done that before they came to us, which is very frequently the case, you know, and there doesn't, so this person has back pain that doesn't really live in their back, then, you know, we move our sights upstream and we look at, well, what's the contributions in the spinal cord? Do we have medications that might help with that? Do we need to correct muscle imbalances? Do we need to correct movement patterns? So physio plays a significant role in that, analyzing movement patterns, biomechanics, etc. Or do we actually need to intervene in a way that goes even higher up into the cortex of the brain, or the areas just under the cortex where a lot of our psychology treatments have their effect?
Yeah, a lot of the research hasn't necessarily. Let me ask you this question: one of the issues that the way we used to understand chronic pain, one of the issues that developed was an over reliance on opioids. We've discussed this on the program before. This was the idea that if you've got a headache and you take a tablet, you can get rid of it.
Yep.
And opioids were a bit different. If you've got back pain, if we give you opioids, you won't feel that pain. The trouble is they're highly addictive, and we've created this huge other problem, haven't we?
Yeah, although I would actually say, from a pain doctor's point of view, the opioids, particularly strong opioids, they can trigger addiction in people whose brains are vulnerable to addiction. But what is actually a bigger problem from a pain management point of view is that we've only relatively recently realized that probably as many as 80% of people on long-term moderate to high dose opioids actually have changes in their nervous system which entrench and worsen the pain. And that's a situation called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, which even today there are some people who don't think it exists. Most of us are pretty convinced that it exists, because nothing else explains the paradox where, with a lot of our patients, when we significantly reduce their opioid dose, their pain is either the same or better. Which is what you would predict if the drugs were making it worse. Problems beyond addiction.
Yeah. I think last time we discussed opioids on the program, where our experts we're talking to said, you know, they could prove that the opioids weren't any longer doing any good. But people felt they were. And I know this is an emotive topic, because people will get angry when they hear this.
Yeah,
because people say, well, you know, I'm the one feeling the pain. I know what makes me feel better.
Yeah, yeah. And look, the situation is a little bit similar to if you have somebody who is given long-term cortisone tablets, for example, to prevent asthma. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have them on that long enough, they will continue to have asthma symptoms, but their body will also have stopped producing its own corticosteroid, and therefore it's not safe to take them off that anymore, because their body will not produce enough native cortisone. So in a similar way, opioids actually within the body are extremely complex molecules, and they have dozens of different actions. And so if you have had 20 years of putting very strong external opioids into that system, which don't have the full range of effects that a normal opioid, you know, your body's own opioids will have, what happens is that your body down regulates its own production of opioids, and it can never get back to where it was. So things like low mood and depression, you know, the opioids are very important in helping to regulate mood. That's one of the reasons why they can be dependence forming. But they can also have significant effects on people's risk of osteoporosis. In men, your testosterone production switches off nearly completely after a couple of years on high-dose opioids. I've had people where they haven't healed from surgery because their growth hormone has completely switched off after opioids. So the problem is that when, you know, there will be some people who can't ever be taken off opioids, and we have to accept that that was something that was caused by our best intentions to help people. We didn't have enough of an understanding of what the long-term ramifications of those high-dose strong opioids were. And although although those people aren't necessarily benefiting from them from a pain point of view, they may still be. The opioids are not placebos. They still can help a bit. But the problem is they're not helping as much as they once were, and they are also causing a lot more harm than we used to think they caused.
Can you understand, when we talk about this topic, why, I'm sure you've had patients tell you this, that patients are, many people hear from these kinds of conversations about what doctors are saying today about chronic pain. They say, well, what I'm hearing from you now is that essentially you're saying, the pain is in my head, and I've got to find some way to deal with that. In other words, I'm not really suffering pain as such. It's in my head. Therefore, the message they're hearing is that it's my fault, not somebody else's fault. And that's a hard message to hear.
That is because it's actually what I don't think is a correct message.
Right.
So when you say that the pain is in your head, it's actually in all of your nervous system. There's no such thing as purely psychological pain, at least not that I think I've ever seen. So there are people where they can develop bodily pain if they're depressed or they're very stressed, but that's actually a normal thing the brain does. You know, there was a very clever study done some years ago in Scandinavia where they looked at, because they have a very good centralized health records, they took the records of people who'd been prescribed antidepressants for the first time. And they went back and looked at those people in the year before their diagnosis of depression. And about 60% of those people had gone to see a doctor with at least one unexplained bodily pain in that year. So depression and low mood does create pain because it makes your pain filtering in the spinal cord very inefficient. So you need an approach that is actually fully comprehensive. And this is the way we do pain management these days. You know, we have the so-called four P's of pain management: pharmacology, procedures, psychology, and physical reactivation. Mm-hmm. And if you're only trying to do one of those things, then you're probably not getting the full range of services you need.
So pharmacology is drugs. Psychology is perhaps talking with someone, counselling, whatever, learning.
It's a lot more than that, yeah.
but that sort of approach to try cognitive behaviour therapy, maybe, to try and
acceptance as
and
well.
Learning to live with it, yeah. Go on.
Sorry, I was going to say acceptance is not quite the same thing as resignation So there is a particular approach in psychology called acceptance commitment therapy, which is extremely helpful for people with chronic pain because nobody expects to get it. You know, you don't ever plan to have chronic pain.
No.
And so you have to have some sort of emotional response to developing it. And sometimes that works in people's favour, sometimes not.
Procedures are what? Surgery, are they?
Now, there's a lot of procedures you can do using needles or injections, as well as implantable devices. Sorry, just giving a bit of a sore throat.
No, that's all right. Just have a cough for a second. When we talked before about it too, I mean, your procedures, all those sorts of things, we've also talked about physical activation. I presume you mean by that by forms of exercise or other forms of bodily movement that can help with the pain.
Yeah, exactly, because bodily movement actually significantly activates the body's natural pain filters. And people who exercise regularly are less likely to develop. It's one of the protective factors against developing chronic pain, because people who exercise regularly tend to have fairly efficient pain filters. People who sleep well also have very efficient pain filters. So doing the basics well, is protective against chronic pain.
All right. I'm talking with Professor Michael Vagg. He's a rehabilitation and pain doctor. He's the Dean of the Faculty of Pain Medicine at the Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists. And we're talking about we're talking about recent advances in our understanding of chronic pain and dealing with chronic pain as well. Shane's been waiting on. Sorry, Shane, you've been waiting on there. Hello.
Yeah, g'day, guys. How are you going tonight?
Not bad.
Good, thanks.
That's great. Listen, I'll just share a little bit of my story. I had surgery when I was 15 on my knees, playing sport. When I was 33, I was diagnosed with chronic pain. Now, at the time, I'm 57 now. At the time, I was injected every time I went to the hospital, which was quite regular to begin with for pain, and I was admitted, I was given pethidine. And, of course, I'd never taken drugs before, and I thought that was just the normal thing that you got. Well, unfortunately, as we know, that it's not a very nice drug, and I become totally addicted to that. But over the last 23 years, I've been on a journey where I've had lots and lots of opiates. I've had pethidine, I've had morphine, I've had endone, I've had methadone for pain, I've had injections, I've had nerve blocks. So, but just recently, and
what's your question here, Shane?
My question is, I'm it's not so much a question, but I just want to agree with you guys, or with the professor, and that yeah. You know, sometimes opiates are not the go, because in 2015 I got Charcot in my feet through diabetes, and I've just had my right leg amputated. Now, I've come out of hospital after 23 years of being on opiates. And when I left the rehabilitation ward, I didn't want any opiates. Mm-hmm. I didn't want any pain relief because I was just over painkillers that I knew were doing harm to my body. You know, I was being given ketamine to basically nearly anaesthetize me. And I thought it was just time to get on with life and realize these things that we're finding out now that are not working is to come to a realisation in my own life that, you know, look, I've got a choice here. I've got a choice of either being on the opiates or a choice of saying, hey, you know what? I'm doing what I'm doing now is seeing a psychologist. I'm having exercise physiology twice a week. I'm doing hydrotherapy. You know, I'm seeing a dietitian eating well. And my pain that I've had for so long has diminished to a point where I don't need opiates.
Okay. I'd just say that's
a really, you know, it's a classic example of changing ways that, you know, that we've approached things. And, you know, there's a lot of focus on opioids. I still have a handful of people that are on moderate opioids. I have some that are, you know, I've inherited from other doctors who've been on very high dose opioids, but these days we try and shift them to some of the newer opioids, which don't have the same problems as the older ones. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you need a team, you know, you need a team around you to help you get the full exposure to all of the things that work.
Mm. Part of the problem, isn't it? Thanks, Shane. Well, part of the problem that in this space is a bit because people often can't get their needs met. That there's a whole industry of stuff has grown up, hasn't it? About what will make you better, you know, I mean, common ones like glucosamine or curcumin, turmeric, and fish oil, for example, which are really commonly advocated and spruiked by commercial interests. There isn't any, as far as I'm aware, scientific evidence that any of these things work, is there?
Yeah, so turmeric or curcumin is an interesting one because the way that came about, as you know, there's often always a little grain of truth with some of these things. And curcumin, I was talking to a friend of mine that I bump into at conferences who's in the pharmaceutical industry. And when you mention curcumin to him, he just shakes his head and says that when you do the screening tests to see whether a particular molecule might be good for a particular purpose, curcumin is one of the most common false positive ones that comes up. It always screens as if it's effective for something. Right. But then when you actually use it in real life, it doesn't tend to work. Right. So I think I agree with you that there is, in fish oil is another interesting one because fish oil is pharmacologically active as long as it is fresh and as long as you have a huge amount of it. So you have to be eating sort of, you know, half a kilo of salmon a day to get enough fish oil fresh into your body to actually make a really substantial difference. But it is pharmacologically active.
Right. What about fish oil capsules?
Yeah, the problem with those is that they've been out of the fish for too long a lot of the time.
Right.
Once it begins to oxidize, it gets turned into a non-pharmacologically active state. And we think that's why a lot of the things where, you know, particularly for cardiac prevention and arthritis treatment, where if people are taking fish oil capsules, generally those studies have shown that they don't work. Yeah. And we think it's probably just because the shelf life of the active form of the oil is really short.
Yeah, because if you go into any chemist shop, I mean, there are shelves of these things, aren't there? Glucose, I mean, is a really common one. I mean, I suspect they go through fashions, do they? Because there's no evidence that glucosamine works either, is there?
Again, glucosamine is a really interesting one because it works in a test tube.
Yeah.
So if you mix a bit of glucosamine and chondroitin with some cartilage cells in a test tube, those cells will begin to divide. But the thing is that there's already a huge amount of glucosamine in your joints. Even if you have significant arthritis, there's already a lot of glucosamine in your joints. And to me, I always thought it would make more sense if you inject the glucosamine directly into the joint rather than eating it in a tablet because it isn't very digestible.
Right.
And I have heard taking glucosamine for joint pain compared to eating hair to try and cure baldness. It's the same sort of idea.
All right. What about, just before I go to some other questions, what about the latest fashion, which is medicinal cannabis? Now, some people swear by this. Again, the medical evidence doesn't really support it, does it?
No, particularly specifically for chronic non-malignant pain, which again, as we've already said, that can cover lots and lots of different types of pain. But, you know, the serious interest in cannabinoids probably peaked in the early 2000s in the pain research. And what they found was that even the best, most useful forms of it seemed to be really no better than something like codeine.
Right.
And in fact, there was a renowned study that was published in 2005 where they took a version of the THC molecule, which had been stabilized into a medication called nabilone, and they put nabilone up head to head against codeine and in a proper randomized controlled trial in people with nerve pain, which is a condition that codeine really doesn't work very well at all for. And even then, the nabilone it was more poorly tolerated and actually not even as effective as the codeine. So people lost a lot of interest in it after that. We're still actively investigating what goes on upstream in the cannabinoid system. Plant-based medicinal cannabis really doesn't prompt a lot of enthusiasm from most pain specialists.
Okay. Veronica, sorry for had to wait on there. Hi, Veronica. What's your question?
Hi. Look, I just wanted to ask, I've had some neck pain through discs that were that contracted and spondylosis, I think it's called. And lately I've had cracked teeth. I'm wondering whether there's been any link with the neck pain and me clenching my jaws at night and cracking my teeth.
The short answer is possibly. So grinding teeth is the medical term for that is bruxism. Pain can be one of the things that triggers people to do more of that. It seems it's certainly not the only possible trigger and probably stress is a more potent trigger for it. But it's not totally crazy. It may well be contributing.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Veronica. Alan, g'day. Hi, Alan.
G'day, guys. How are you?
Well,
good, thanks.
And not too bad. 2007, I injured my back. The L5 disc is not that good. So, look, I've been on the medication merry-go-round. And, everything under the sun they prescribed me, but nothing seemed to work. And I was also getting sciatica in my right leg. So the doctor, who's now retired, got me a permit or applied for a permit to prescribe me a fentanyl patch. Now, what I have to do is every month, now I see another doctor who's an anaesthetist, who explained to me a hell of a lot more than what the original doctor told me. But if I don't have them, my body and my brain just goes crazy, if you know what I mean. So, but the doctor says it's not drug addiction, it's drug dependence, and there's a big difference between addiction and dependence. And the thing is, there's been a couple of times I haven't been able to see my doctor, and I've had to see a registrar. You know, no offence, but they come from a different country, and they seem to be so scared to prescribe anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fun. So I'm on the fentanyl patch, and I'm also on Lyrica for the sciatica. And I do get constipation a lot, but I find eating digestive biscuits works the best. I mean, I've tried all sorts of stuff for constipation, but the old digestive biscuits, they seem to...
Okay, well, I guess that's the point of them, isn't it? Yeah. What Alan's distinction between dependence and addiction?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because certainly in the group of patients that we see in pain management, we try and separate out dependence and physical dependence and tolerance, which are not unique to opioids. They happen with lots of medications, and that is kind of a separate issue to addiction. So physical dependence refers to the fact that someone's body is adapted to being on the medication. So if it's suddenly not there, then you get a withdrawal syndrome. And fentanyl patches are particularly prone to doing that, because fentanyl is an extremely strong opioid that's delivered in tiny, tiny doses.
Yeah.
So it's very prone to causing physical dependence. It's also prone to the second thing that is kind of confused with addiction a lot of the time, and that's called tolerance. So with opioids, the more you're on and the longer you're on them for, generally speaking, you have to increase the dose to get the same effect over time. And that's a phenomenon called tolerance. Again, not unique to opioids, but it's a real limiting problem, particularly for very strong opioids like fentanyl patches, is that they often stop working and then you have to increase the dose if you want them to keep working. But addiction really refers to compulsive use. So in other words, you don't have really good control over the behavior. You will tend to do it whether you want to or not, and you will tend to do it even when it's causing you significant harm, or even when it's causing you to get in trouble with the law, to get in trouble with the people around you, but you just keep craving it and you keep doing it. And that's really the difference between addiction and the other two, is that many of my patients that are still on opioids are either physically dependent or tolerant or both. As far as I'm aware, very few of them are actually addicted, because there are particular patterns that tend to go along with people's medication use and their prescribing behavior when they're addicted, and they will, and you know, the advent of this new SafeScript website in Victoria has gone a long way towards helping us identify people who are getting drugs from multiple prescribers or whose doses are escalating very rapidly, and that triggers that conversation that you know, maybe that person has a problem of addiction rather than pain, or they may have both.
Mm. Okay, thanks, Alan. Annie, g'day.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Professor, for taking my call. I had an injury 20 months ago. I had surgery last December. I had a shattered shoulder and a total replacement surgery. I've been told now that I have post-operative arthritis. I'm still on Targin, Lyrica and paracetamol, but I try and keep them to a minimum. I'm trying to reduce that pain medication. I'm finding that I'm still getting a lot of pain. My surgeon told me that prior to the surgery and after the surgery, that the endeavour for the surgery was for me to be able to be as pain-free as possible, but the mobility that I would have would never be as good because of the amount of,
injury that I had.
Yes. What's your question here, Annie?
My question is, what would you prescribe or think that I should do to try and regain more strength and or less pain? I've had a lot of physiotherapy. I'm now finding that it's starting to affect me emotionally, and starting.
Let's put it back to Michael, Annie.
Thanks. So it takes around 12 months to fully rehabilitate a total shoulder. So believe it or not, you've still got a bit to go in that respect before it's as good as it's going to get. And I think working with your GP to work out a weaning schedule and, you know, what's a reasonable expectation for, you know, what's the rate that you're going to be able to reduce your medications at and which ones to do in what order and what you're expecting each one to do is really, really important at this stage, because a lot of people end up on long-term opioids that were started on them post-surgery, but they never quite have a plan for how they're going to actually be able to get off them. And so if it's a shoulder which has, you know, undergone a pretty traumatic history and then surgery and you know, there's a very long tail to trying to wean off the medications, that's really exactly the sort of situation that a pain specialist can help with. So I think certainly asking your GP maybe to refer you to a pain specialist or a pain clinic to give you a plan to help, because there may be some procedures, for example, we often do with shoulders that can temporarily reduce the input from some of the nerves around the shoulder for a period of a few weeks or months that enables you to get off the medication and get it moving a bit better. And then the movement is actually the thing that in the long run will give you the best pain relief. But shoulders are tricky and they do take a long time to get as good as they're going to get once they've had a big operation.
Okay. Good luck with it, Annie. Rodney from Mount Isa. Hi, Rod. Hi, Rodney.
Yes, Phil.
Yes, Rodney.
Right. I wanted to talk to the professor about peripheral neuropathy, which I suffered from chronically. And it started off about 8-9 years ago, just as a difference in temperature in my feet and legs. The feet were cold and the legs were hot. I don't know, as it progressed over the years, it's become to where now I've just got this totally burning sensation in my feet all the time. Sometimes when I'm walking on my feet, it's like there's a buzzing, like electrical buzzing in your toes, your toes are all swollen.
Yeah, so that's what we call, so peripheral neuropathy is a condition where there is deterioration of the nerves out in the sort of the far reaches of the nervous system, normally the feet first and then the hands maybe, as if you're really unlucky. But the nerves that go down to the feet are the longest nerves in the body, so they're often the first ones to be affected by peripheral neuropathy. When you get a painful peripheral neuropathy, it's usually because those nerves which have been injured as part of the neuropathy are trying to heal, but they're not quite getting there. And sometimes the membranes of those nerves can be very unstable. And the result of that is exactly what you're noticing, which is that those unstable membranes fire strongly and they produce a pain sensation with the sort of input that normally would get ignored or filtered by the nervous system. So there are a handful of medications which can be quite helpful with peripheral neuropathy. There are some other sort of slightly trickier, more advanced things that we sometimes do to help people with neuropathy in the procedures side of things. But it is one of those. It's one of those ones where actually the biomedical treatments often tend to work a little better than some of the psychology and physio type treatments.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
But nerve pain of that type is a particularly challenging one.
Yeah. Okay. Just back to those four P's that we talked about earlier: pharmacology, psychology, procedures, and physical activation. So we're talking about these are ways which sometimes might be used together, might they, to treat chronic pain? Just back to the four P's that we're talking about, the four P's of chronic pain: pharmacology, psychology, procedures, and physical activation. So drugs, some sort of psychological approaches, some procedures which may involve, injections, some surgery perhaps, and exercise. Yep. Now, is part of the problem that getting practitioners or getting people to activate and have a suite of these treatments is not happening, and that if it was, we'd treat the whole thing better?
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, there is a national strategic action plan for pain management, which has been developed with input from all the pain groups in the country. That unfortunately, the consideration of that by the federal minister and the state ministers has been a bit derailed by what else is going on in the country at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's a key part of that entire strategy. A lot of the problems we have with, Lyrica overuse, opioid overuse, people with poor mental health outcomes, leaving the workforce early, a lot of these things are actually deficits of proper access and equitable access to pain management that is done according to the best practice way that we know how to do it.
So if you've got money to spend on doctors, you'll get a better outcome.
But also if you're able to travel, if you're able to, as you can imagine, people don't tend to have life-threatening episodes of chronic pain. Although it ruins people's lives, it's not the direct cause of a lot of mortality. So acute hospitals think, well, we're here for people who are having severe acute injuries, et cetera, et cetera. Rehabilitation hospitals are there for people who are recovering from, an acute event. But often chronic pain falls through the cracks because you need to have a really well set up pain service can have links to the acute hospital. So we have acute pain nurses. So the hospital where I work, we have acute pain nurses that can see people on the wards, within hours of their operation. We can follow them through the rehabilitation phase via our clinic, or we can see them for months or years afterwards. Mm-hmm. And, we're sort of a one-stop shop. And it's taken a huge amount of work and effort to get that in place. And there are public clinics that are set up like that. There just isn't enough of them. And, accessibility for people
equity of access is a problem.
Equity of access is a massive problem.
Yeah,
massive
problem. Can we just talk briefly about work cover? I mean, you say that's a system that works if you have a catastrophic injury, but not very good for people who experience chronic pain. Why not?
So certainly here in Victoria, the work cover system is set up so that if you have an injury that occurs, you're disabled for a little while, then you get better and go back to work. It works really well. If you have a very severe injury, again, it's set up to deal with that sort of thing. There's lifetime support and people have a good experience and they're well supported. But a lot of people in the middle, which is most of my patients, where they're expected to get better, but they don't really get as good as what everyone thought they would because they develop chronic pain. And, in other states that I'm aware of, there are strict time limits to how long you can be on work cover and get your medical care paid for. And after that, you just default to the public health system or private if you've managed to put some money together. But the part of the problem with work cover is you have to keep proving that you're sick. Otherwise, you're expected to go back to work. And that's the exact opposite of what you should be trying to do with someone who's got chronic pain. You need to be helping them. You need to be incentivizing them to do better with support so that they can work their way out of the problem. And you have to be open to the idea that people may not get back to their original type of work. And certainly in Victoria, the work cover system here in Victoria is the only government agency that's ever been investigated more than once by the state ombudsperson.
Sure. All right. Look, Jody from Sussex Inlet, just before, because time is beating us, but Jody says on the text line, I was addicted to Endone and any other opioid. I was referred to a pain clinic. I had every excuse in the world to need opioids, but I was terribly addicted. I began the Suboxone, then buprenoid treatment. It saved my life.
Mm.
It saved my life. I'm opioid free. I only take Panadol and Nurofen. I have memory and self-esteem. I stretch. Mm. I drink water instead of swallowing tablets. I had a four-disc fusion in my neck and multiple abdominal operations, but yep. I live life now, not exist, says Jody. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In other words, there is a way out of it. In other words,
oh, absolutely, and actually, Suboxone is a very interesting one because that was a treatment which was developed for addiction.
Yeah.
And in here in Victoria, I've been able to use that for pain management patients for a couple of years now, along with quite a few of my colleagues, and it really is a very, very effective way of helping people who are on those very high doses get off them.
Sure. All right. Look, talk to your doctor and seek some sort of multidisciplinary approach, seems to be what you're saying.
Exactly. Yep. Find a team.
Yep.
Find a team.
Okay. Michael, unfortunately, time's beaten us, but I do thank you for your expertise. Thank you.
That's a pleasure, Philip. Thanks so much.
Associate Professor Michael Vagg, Dean of the Faculty of Pain Medicine at the Australian New Zealand College of Anaesthetists.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.